right, Veeam Community Podcast listeners, this is Clint Wyckoff. This week we are at Microsoft Ignite 2017 here in Orlando, Florida. It is Tuesday, I think it's still Tuesday. The days start to blend together pretty quickly at these shows, but today I'm actually joined by a good friend. I actually think this is the first time we've ever met in person. We've talked a lot on Twitter and stuff, but I think this is the first time we've ever actually put a face to a name, so that's pretty cool.
Well, if we had, it's been in passing, so longer than 5 minutes.
Yeah, and it seems like I've seen you 20 different times since we've been here.
Oh, yeah. It all started on day one. I think I was here for a grand total of 3 minutes in the food court, and you go wandering by.
The world in IT is very, very, very small, so in case you're wondering, I'm here with John Hildebrand. And John is, I think it's at Snoop J on Twitter.
At Snoop J 123.
123. Is there a story behind that Snoop J?
Oh, it's silly shenanigans from high school.
Okay.
And it just stuck. And it ended up being unique, and unfortunately, like most Twitter names, I had to add numbers on the end of it.
One of our vanguards, Jim Jones, has he's Kool-Aid IT, and he's got like a whole story behind how he got his Twitter handle.
Mm-hmm.
So like I said, we're here at Ignite. What's your takeaway so far? What's been your focus? What are you looking into?
Well, part of my forte at the moment is dealing a lot with Azure and the upcoming Azure Stack solution. Mm-hmm. So the company I work for, we're in the early adopter initiative, so we're out here just trying to make sure that the information's still lining up. They're getting more and more hardware providers, OEM providers added to it. So just seeing what they have in the mix and seeing what else may be coming forth, because there's a lot of transition from public Azure then sliding into Azure Stack for those on-premises implementations.
So what do you kind of see as your main use case? Like, what excites you, interests you about Azure Stack?
Well, I think a lot of it is due to the fact that inside of my data center, without having, to overhaul everything, I can start to work with a platform that deals more and is more integrated with more cloud-native technologies.
Okay.
So I work for a service provider, and we see a lot of, I guess, I could get in trouble for calling it legacy technology, your traditional virtualized client server, monolithic applications. And we're, even in the small to medium size and low-end enterprise, we're starting to see people starting to talk about cloud-native, moving refactoring applications, going that direction to something that makes more sense to get away from some of the legacy stacks that they're stuck on.
Okay.
So this is just a natural progression in our portfolio to add from, we go all the way from co-location services now all the way up to pushing some of the boundaries on cloud technologies.
So you wouldn't kind of do wholesale, this is the only thing that we offer. This is just another like SKU on your book of business, your line card of what you offer.
I look at it as like a timeline to some degree. We can go from people who just want to get out of maybe the glorified broom closet they may have a couple of servers into inside a data center, all the way to, hey, we have a consulting division that can help you kind of re-architect those applications moving forward. And we have the data center space for it to happen.
Sure. So I think, those traditional monolithic servers, application developers, infrastructure guys, a big part of like bridging the gap there and helping them get more towards cloud native is just having better discussions with each other and having open door and being willing to kind of adopt the change and not like, the infrastructure guys kind of, they like to hug their servers. They they don't want to let go of that power.
Yeah.
And if you're going to, give a developer the ability to automatically spawn up and spin up and spin down applications on demand, that can kind of make it infrastructure guy really like worry.
There's always what do they always say, that change is inevitable.
Yes.
And change is scary for some individuals. One of the things that I know, there are days where I feel like it's my first day in IT, and then there's some days where I have to remember that I'm now getting to 20 plus years in this industry. But one of the things that I like to pride myself in is I feel like I'm malleable. I can go from one technology to another and adopt it relatively quickly, or at least get up to speed and get excited about it. So the concept of getting away from server hugging and going into things more like data center automation, or and then moving more towards some of like, you know, some of the cloud native approaches where you start getting into letting developers basically spin up their own application instances without really asking infrastructure people a single question. That actually excites me to some degree. I mean, if you think about it, the last thing I want to end up doing is continuously hugging that server.
Yeah.
And or as I always like to say, I like to take vacation once in a while too. So, you know, being able to step away from that server at the same time and not have to babysit it, almost like a Wizard of Oz, always constantly pulling the levers on it to keep it up and running.
Right.
That doesn't excite me anymore.
So what do you kind of see as an easy way for somebody to kind of get started into the more automation style of the world? What is your...
Well, when you start to think a little bit, now I'll bring up the dreaded D word, DevOps.
Yes.
But there's a lot of misconceptions and things related to it. Actually, that's one of the things that I do a lot of presentations now at VMUGs and VMUG user cons is about the topic of DevOps and what it actually means to operations for personnel. First and foremost, it's not really about the technical side. It's mostly about IT culture and just getting all those groups aligned on the same page.
Yeah.
And what that also means is for the first time in ages, some of these organizations, developers will sit in the same room with operations folk so that you can essentially shorten the distance between issues that are in the system and be able to resolve them quicker. You know, you may have heard in the keynote here, Satya was talking about feedback loops.
Yeah.
You know, shorten them as much as possible so that it doesn't take that long between different groups like it used to with lobbing things over silo walls back and forth to try to figure out what an issue is. So really what it comes down to is being a little more empathetic and working with some of these groups that traditionally maybe you wouldn't. And what that means is you may blend some skills with some of the developers. You may get into scripting languages and up to and maybe bump into even what you would consider programming languages to some degree. I mean, I know from my perspective, I'm a PowerShell guy.
Yes.
And one of the, I think 5.0 introduced some of the concepts, some C-sharp components that you could natively integrate into it, like classes and things like that. So you can almost write your own object types that you want to, where traditionally you'd have to be a full C-sharp programmer to do that. So you're starting to see that gray line, a little bit more gray color between infrastructure automation and development, you know, starting to be less black and white and more gray.
Yeah.
So now I'm struggling here because I think I remember what the original question was, but I think that kind of went into the fact that I think it's inevitable.
Yeah.
Scripting is inevitable. The low-level, low-hanging fruit details that we have to do in our jobs that traditionally you would... I mean, both of us come from a vSphere background at the same time. So right-clicking in vCenter, no. Go pick up
Power
CLI, learn about the SDKs for your language of choice, and interact in that method, because you can start to then chain things together, and one task then becomes a huge workflow that all of a sudden becomes a complete deliverable that your organization can do.
Yeah, I mean, the way that whenever I was kind of on the IT end user side of the fence, I used to go and look at calls that would come into the help desk, which ones generated the most calls. And chances are it's probably like 80 password lockout, 80 password reset, something as simple as that. If you can automate just a small portion of what generates calls at the help desk, that is, I mean, A, that's automation, and B, that's making somebody's life inside of your IT organization a lot easier. And then you can go and focus on doing other things and make it bigger, like you said.
No, as you were stating there, pain. Pain is one heck of a motivator.
Yes.
If you do not like doing the same task 80 times during the course of a day, you're going to put forth the effort to learn how to take care of that in a short amount of time that doesn't involve your full attention to have to do it. And that's really where a lot of things start within operations is find your pain points, figure out where you're losing most of your time at, And once you start to automate that pain away, now you can actually focus on the things that you really want to focus on moving forward, whether it's adopting new technologies or taking things to a whole new level with a technology suite that maybe you already have in your data center.
Sure. So you did mention the D word, DevOps.
Oh, yeah.
Pretend I'm an idiot. Maybe I am an idiot. I don't know. Well, that's depending on who you ask. And your definition, because depending on who you ask, you get a different definition.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about what is DevOps.
Well, I'm in the camp where I truly believe it's more of a cultural revolution than it is a technological or, well, since we're talking cultural, it's more of a people revolution thing. I think those of us who have been in the industry long enough know that for the longest time, IT has been considered to be more of a cost sink, not necessarily a business enabler. And that's starting to change a little bit now that you're starting to see the various groups, because traditionally development would be where the new things would be coming from inside of organizations. That would be where the new business would be coming from. Because of the separation of the IT away from it, we go back again to the feedback loops and things getting done. You know, you remember the days where it used to take 6 months maybe to provision a server? And now we're talking about, with shortening and automation and things from the operation side, minutes to do what we used to have. We used to have to wait months to do. So from that perspective, all we're trying to do is align all those groups under the same business goals. To realize that on IT, we're not trying to protect our fiefdom. You know, we go back to the server hugger argument. We're not trying to protect just that. That is a component that enables so much more. And just to basically bring into alignment the business goals that both development and operations are both part of the equation to deliver what the business truly is trying to accomplish.
I know whenever I was kind of, again, I go back to that because that's what I know, is whenever I was on the IT side of the fence, we were seen as a bottleneck. Because every time somebody would come and say, you know, I need servers, blah, 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 it would be, like you said, a couple, two, three-week process of change controls, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, we don't have enough hosts in the environment. We got to buy a new ESX host, get more memory. Oh, wait, we got to talk to the backup team. And it was this big, long loop, as you mentioned, because the priority for us being an infrastructure is different than what the priority of a developer is. His job is to write code. I need to get this out the door as quick as possible. So one of the things that we started to do is meet with business analysts on a quarterly basis to understand, hey, this is what you're doing today. What are you going to need in the next, say, 12 months or so? What are your plans? So that we, as IT infrastructure, could be better planned. And that creates relationships, and then there's comfort level, and now you can just walk over to somebody's cube and have a conversation with them, whereas before, that it just wasn't possible. Like, you don't, like, speak the same language.
Yeah, or as you were mentioned, or I've heard other people mention, complete open hostility between the groups. So it's very hard to establish, because one of the main factors that you got to have between those two groups is trust. And if you have open hostility, that is like the complete opposite of trust at that point. So there's a lot of relationship building that needs to be done first and foremost. So what it ends up coming down to is, the reason I say it's not really technologically focused is the fact that that trust is being done more at different levels than just aligning a developer with a technology. It's no different than, there's this book that I'm reading, it's by Dr. Sidney Decker, about just cultures, and it talks about safety organizations. So go into things like the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, and what they do for the oversight for the airline industry and things like that, and how their primary goal isn't necessarily to point fingers at anybody, but it's there to kind of make sure that there's still a lot of trust from the public in that system, so to speak, because in the past, those organizations were taking a lot of shortcuts, accidents were happening, trust was plummeting would be the wrong word for that organization, but
on the decline.
Yeah, so it's one of those to put the public trust, or in this case, to put customer trust back in your organization. You kind of got to get everybody on the same page.
You do.
It can't be IT off doing their own thing, developers off doing their own thing, because one of the things that will end up happening, we'll kind of bring up the concept of shadow IT.
Yeah.
I mean, that sprung up because IT completely failed to deliver what developments and the business actually wanted. They were able to go get simple things like, well, I just need a virtual machine, I need a virtual machine spun up. Why does it take 3 weeks for a virtual machine when I know, I've done enough right-clicking to know that
it's really easy.
Yeah, it's probably at worst case a couple of minutes and then a little bit of customization to the virtual machine after it's done. So the tools have always been there. It's just there hasn't been, I don't know, I would think a lot of traditional IT shops haven't been up until now, until recently, haven't gotten the message that they really need to get in line with the business.
Yes.
Because sooner or later, because now the rest of the business has found a way around it.
Yeah, and chances are the developers, if you're standing in the way as an infrastructure guy and you're a bottleneck, he's going to do his work someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to go put their own credit card down and expense it on Azure or Amazon, AWS, or even Google Cloud, whatever, and they're going to go do their development out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that's, you know, they need something that the infrastructure is not really their concern. They just want to get to that application layer, and that's what those things provide. Very minimalist approach to what you're getting in the infrastructure. You get it, you know, like snap of the fingers, almost, I wouldn't say instantly, but you get it a heck of a lot quicker than weeks.
And chances are, once you bridge the gap, have those conversations, the technology will come secondhand. You've already, probably already have the technology in-house and the knowledge of to make the scripting and the necessary mm-hmm. changes there happen. It's, like you said, the trust and the, I would say, you know, the political mm-hmm. changes and policy changes as well. You know, one of the kind of inhibitors whenever I was on that side was the change process that we had in mm-hmm. place. And it just, you had to go through a change advisory board just to build a simple virtual machine inside of a production environment. You had to go through a CAB to explain the business justification and a backout plan and all the mm-hmm. all that stuff to go along with it. So it is definitely an uphill battle if you're in an environment that might not be as open to change or adoption as maybe some other companies.
Well, but I think we've well established in the industry, I think at this particular point, DevOps isn't a fad. It's not going away, and it has been changing the way some businesses are seeing success nowadays. So some of those things, it is just inevitable, sooner or later they will have to change. Mm-hmm. The old ITIL model, the drag everything through the mud, to catch up to what the business needs nowadays, you can't have things be drugged through a 6-week process before something can even happen, especially when this other model is sitting out there and you hear the Etsy's and the Netflixes of the world talking about, hey, we change the production system 20 times a day.
Yeah.
And you can't change it once in 6 weeks. There's inevitably a problem. You're not keeping up with that pace of innovation out there.
See, I think a downfall, and this is where I come from, followed an ITIL framework, is that ITIL is open to interpretation on, and I think there's good things inside of ITIL, but they get implemented poorly mm-hmm. inside of, it's like Sarbanes-Oxley, right? Sarbanes-Oxley is this big, long policies and procedures, but it's open to how you interpret it and how you actually use it inside of your environment and what you document, mm-hmm. okay? So ITIL is this entire framework of, you know, change, incident, problem, blah, 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 management, but they just get implemented poorly inside of large enterprises.
I would even go one step further that sometimes, so we start talking about now what I've heard dubbed the golden triangle, people, process, and technology.
Yeah.
And what you get for a lot of very strict interpretations of ITIL is almost direct from the framework itself.
Yeah.
They don't necessarily make it their own, but they continue to try to change the organization to the framework rather than go the other way around.
Yeah.
So it's one of those, they've almost put too much trust and almost treat the ITIL framework as the gospel itself rather than trying to adapt it to the rest of the organization. Now, when you go to the DevOps side of the equation, it has to adapt, because if you want that speed and execution that it tends to do with that many iterations potentially you could be doing of an application during the course of a single day, you can't have things like a 6-week CAB process to change one minor function within an application that may then have a ripple effect down to the infrastructure that it's running.
Sure.
So it's just one of those that we see it all across different, if you want to call it the silos mm-hmm. that we used to have. I mean, I know any validated framework, whether it's ITIL or a Cisco validated networking topology design, too many people put too much faith into the direct framework itself and forget that they have to adapt their own business to it at the same time. Or that's the struggle. They don't understand their people and process enough to actually tie that all together and really be successful.
So in your kind of DevOps mind, are you seeing a large interest from your customers or your in containers? Are they pushing you to kind of go that way because that's kind of the easiest way to rinse and repeat in deploying applications? Or is it still based on, you know, vSphere and Hyper-V, or what?
We're kind of in that middle ground area.
Okay.
As my service provider role, I don't work specifically on it, but we'll go back to like AS400 systems, old mm-hmm. mainframe systems. So we're taking that burden away from customers to do it on premises and put it in our data center. That then allows them to, instead of focus on the day-to-day components of keeping the mainframe up, now if they want to add a new spruce, say a new coat of paint mm-hmm. on the outside of the application framework, now various parts, you can still access it because it's in the data center, but now put maybe a containerized web front end on the front of it, or at least start the natural breakaway of all those components that then you want to then individually piece out and scale out in a different fashion, rather than just focus purely on, we have this AS400 and we're just going to keep putting a new coat of paint, and the next thing you know, you're up to version 436,
yeah.
and the paint is thicker than the AS400 itself.
Interesting. So, like I mentioned, we're here at Ignite. You mentioned Azure Stack. What do you think? This is just in your opinion. You've been part of a lot of the early adopter programs of Azure Stack. Before we wrap this up, what do you think the adoption is going to be like? This is the John opinion.
Well, I have some data points in my head, so we're going to, I'm not going to shoot from the hip on this one, but even from what I know in the early adopter initiative, there hasn't been a complete two-foot jump in mm-hmm. Into the lake, so to speak, based on a wing and a prayer mm-hmm. type of. People are still filling this out because they want to make sure that it actually works as advertised. I mean,
sure.
this is a huge endeavor on Microsoft's part.
I mean,
they are literally taking the scaled-out approach of Azure and giving you a small subset of it, but on a completely different hardware platform. So that's why there's been this slow, methodic build out. I mean, we haven't really got to big scale units yet. There's limitations to how many regions and the amount of servers and things like that you can have in there right now. So it's limited. And what some people, like myself as a service provider, I have multiple data centers. I would love to see the ability to have multiple regions within my own data center construct. But we all have to start off somewhere. So I think just getting organizations comfortable with it, because at the same time they're trying to target a lot of organizations that haven't made the jump to public cloud constructs. So this gives them a little bit of a playground, and as long as they're able to continue to support it and continue to innovate and push some of those new Azure public functionality down to Azure Stack and continue to grow it for guys like myself in the service provider realm, it's going to be relatively successful. There's that middle gap between public cloud and on-premises works that, like, you know, AWS has been famous for saying, we're not going to do anything, we want everybody to go public. Microsoft has decided they're going to put something right in the middle of it.
Well, they realize people still want to have workloads that run inside of their data center. They still mm-hmm. want to own it. My personal opinion, you mentioned before, is Microsoft still going to support it? So there's that piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
The predecessor to Azure Stack was Windows Azure Pack, which wasn't around very long. We've seen what they've done with NanoServer.
Mm-hmm.
NanoServer came out. It was able to be an infrastructure role, Hyper-V. Now all of a sudden they kind of ripped the carpet out on that. You can only run it as a container host mm-hmm. now. So is Azure Stack for real? That's to be determined. Is it going to hang around? To be determined. What's the adoption going to be like? To be determined. I think one of the limiting factors of it is it forces you to buy a specific type of hardware
mm-hmm.
from a specific OEM.
But on top of it, it does make sense. They want to control the entire ecosystem, and that includes working with individual OEMs for driver compatibility.
Correct.
And things like that. So initially, for the sake of making it a success, they have to control everything. At some particular point, they will be able to open it up and say, a super micro device with your own particular pass-through RAID card, local for the local disk subsystem, and you choose what you want to put underneath of it.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be forthcoming. It's just initially, they want to control V1.0 and make sure that it is a success.
Sure.
Because if it's not a success, boy, you stumble right out of the gate.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, don't get me wrong. And I mean, I'm on board with the why. I just think it's going to limit who adopts it. That's all I'm saying. And it's maybe for the listeners that aren't aware, John, what are the OEM providers that are on board right away?
Well, the initial ones were Lenovo, HPE, and Dell EMC. But as they've announced, I believe here, Cisco now has their validated stack.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's Huawei.
Huawei, yeah.
I believe has another one. So I think they're up to five. But because I was in the early adopter initiative, I was only able to choose from the initial three. So being to not probably too many details in my day job, but we were a Cisco partner. So it had to be an adjustment to choose one of the other three because everything x86 in our data center has a Cisco logo on it.
Right.
So having to choose one of the other ones became another architectural run-through of putting three vendors against each other and
through the paces.
Yeah, running the scorecard and see which one is going to be the one that's right. Going to be more comfortable to use in our data center. So
those are sealed configurations. Microsoft controls the drivers, the BIOS, the firmware, the updates, everything that gets pushed down to those physical hosts.
Yeah. Up to and including also networking stack components. So your top of rack and your aggregate switches are hand selected because you have all sorts of things like storage spaces direct and so RDMA and some VXLAN offloads and things like that for the Azure networking within those boxes to have optimized within the stack. So there's a lot of moving parts in those things, and to try to put it down as one OEM thing to order and one OEM thing to try to update, that's a monumental task.
Awesome. So kind of anything to add here in closing before we wrap it up?
I would say for some, me being a PowerShell guy, I'm kind of missing the fact there's not a PowerShell booth over in the Microsoft area. But at the same time, if I'm not mistaken, in about 45 minutes, there's actually a PowerShell meetup, but it's all the way in the other zip code or the other building for those that
are... It is pretty far away.
So I have to go hoofing it for 20 minutes to go over to that one.
Through the swampland.
Yes.
Because it's about 95 degrees outside with 110% humidity, what is what it feels like. So I actually had my Uber drop me off on this side because the bus that I have to take drops off on the complete other side. And yesterday it was a big fiasco just trying to get over here. So instead I just bypassed all that and got dropped off here today and didn't have to walk through the swamp.
Yeah. Well, as I go through the swamp, if I have any gators or anything that I got to step on along the way, I'll play my human version of Frogger to get back over there.
Well, man, hey, it's great to have you on the show finally. I appreciate your time. And again, this is Microsoft Ignite 2017, and we'll talk to you soon.